With the school year underway and summer long come and gone, for many of us, our lives have kicked into overdrive. We've got errands to run and work and social plans and family obligations. The phrase crazy busy gets used a lot by a lot of us. But our guest this hour is here to talk us through some ways to honor our true selves in the midst of the chaos. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert, keeping you company on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Parker Palmer joins us in studio this hour. He's a founder and senior partner of the Center for Courage and Renewal and the author of many books, including The Courage to Teach and Healing the Heart of Democracy. And we'd love to hear from you this hour. Are you able to keep track of your own values and your sense of self when you're crazy busy? And how about sharing your voice in a pressurized political season like the one we're in now? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send your email to talk@wpr.org or weigh in on our Facebook page at The Veronica Rickert Show. And Parker Palmer, thank you so much for coming into the studio today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
And I was checking out your Facebook page last night, and I'm going to check. Did you actually shine your shoes?
I didn't. Nor am I wearing a suit.
Where's the suit? I was promised a suit and shine shoes.
I was always told that one should look good on radio, so I...
Well, your shoes are shiny. They don't look like they needed shining, so I'll give you a free pass on that one.
Thank you.
Well, it seems like the pace of life has dramatically picked up in the last 5-10 years. We've got these smartphones that we're attached to all the time, and we're hyper-connective. And we're in this pretty heavy political season right now as well, which sort of lends to this frantic background buzz. How can we learn to slow down and keep track of who we are when life is so busy?
Well, it's a big question. It's an important and complicated question. But I guess the first thing I'd like to say, Veronica, is that I don't think it's a new question. Not at all. I'm a great fan of Eastern spiritualities, and I read stories by Xuang Tzu, for example, who lived in the 4th century B.C., and he's talking already then in a rural agrarian society about the craziness of life and how difficult it is to stay centered and how difficult it is to inhabit true self.
Really?
And so the conclusion that I have to draw from that is it goes beyond the notion that our world keeps getting busier and busier and more complex. And it goes deeper, I think, to the idea that this is something human beings carry inside themselves in whatever kind of world they occupy. And the question is, what is that driver inside of us? What is that frenzy inside of us? Obviously, it can be triggered and multiplied by the frenzy of the external world, but I don't think we can blame it all on external circumstances.
So if the guy in the farming village hundreds of years ago is feeling busy, we don't really have a good excuse. So you're saying we sort of carry this roil of emotions and feeling kind of churned up inside us as sort of our own emotional baggage.
I think that we do. And I think that's why all of the wisdom traditions, from the philosophical to the spiritual, have really talked about taking an inner journey and taking responsibility for our own inner lives in a way that can help us interact with the world in a more creative manner. I mean, when I sit for a moment and think about my daily life, I become very aware that the reality that I live in is co-created by what I bring from within myself and put into the world around me, and then how I internalize what the world sends back my way, and how much of that and what kind of stuff I'm willing to let in to my inner awareness. So I think it's a step in the right direction to say we co-create the world we live in, both as individuals and in community with each other. And we have important decisions to make about what kind of world we want to co-create.
Just now you used the word creative when you were talking about the way that we interact with the world. It's an interesting choice of word. You could have picked something else. You could have picked, you know, centered or positive, but you picked the word creative. Why?
Well, that taps an interesting moment in my life, which maybe goes back 30 or 35 years. I'm 73 now, so that's a while. I was reading a lot of the spiritual literature on getting centered, and I was attracted to it. Centered sounds like a good thing. And then I woke up one morning wondering why it is then that I'm most attracted to eccentric people. Eccentric, of course, meaning off-center in some creative way. And so I'm not sure that, I mean, being centered is great if it means living a life that on the outside is congruent with what I hold to be dear and true on the inside. So my activities, my relationships, the things I say have congruence with my own authenticity, with my deepest values and beliefs. But if centered means a kind of, I guess the big word is homeostasis, if it means simply settling into some private place of rest, I don't think that's what the world needs from us. The world needs engagement, but it needs engagement that comes from a place of clarity and groundedness in ourselves.
So you just told me before we went on air that you feel crazy busy. And you're 73 now. You said maybe you should be slowing down, but you're the boss. You can't quit, and you're doing things that you love. How do you handle the crush of what comes at you? Knowing, I mean, if anyone is aware of all the things that you're talking about, the virtues of knowing who you are and being true to yourself and interacting with the world in a way that's true to yourself, you know, it's you. So do you feel like you found a balance, or does someone like you still struggle with these ideas that we're talking about?
Well, you know, I think every writer and speaker who's halfway honest about what he or she does will say that they spend a lot of time talking to themselves. That's why I write about what I write about, is these are things I struggle with. And so no claims of perfection from me. I think these are ongoing issues that you have to reflect on every day. And different people have different ways of dealing with them. For me, when I find myself in a frenzy, and it does happen, it's very important for me, first of all, to recognize that I'm in a frenzy and not just accept that as a normal and natural state of affairs. I have an elevated heartbeat, maybe. I'm not breathing well. I'm short-tempered with people around me. I mean, there are many signs. A job that should take me an hour or two in writing takes me a day or two because my head is just a swirl with possibilities and I haven't focused my thoughts. So at times like that, simple things help me. One is changing my rhythm. Get away from the word processor for a while and go take a walk in the woods. Sit in silence for half an hour. Read poetry. I find many of the great poets, people who help me come back to my center, who remind me of who I am and how I want to be. So I don't think these are questions that get settled once and for all in a person's lifetime. I think they're every day, every moment kinds of questions that you have to keep paying attention to. And of course, that phrase, pay attention, is one that runs throughout the wisdom traditions and throughout the spiritual traditions.
Now, one thing that we keep hearing lately, you know, as a response to the freneticism of the world, is that we need to slow down, maybe to unplug from the computer. You talked about stepping back and maybe going for a walk in the woods and reading poetry. Do you think that we need to slow down? Or is it possible to be at the speed that we're at and still be our best selves?
I have a friend, a wonderful singer-songwriter named Carrie Newcomer, with whom I do some work. And she has a new song out about living at the speed of the soul. I like that a lot. I think the speed of the soul is the natural human speed. I think that we need to work on not getting caught up in the frenzy around us, which is another form of giving ourselves away. And we do need to give ourselves to some things. I think we need to be careful and discerning about what we give ourselves to. Let me tell you a little tiny teaching story that comes to me often when I'm in having this conversation with other people or with myself. The story is about a master surgeon who was teaching her students about a critical moment in open heart surgery. And she said, "At this moment, you have exactly 60 seconds to tie off that artery before the patient dies. So you had better take your time." Now, when I heard that story, I thought, that's one of the most real-life stories I've ever heard, and I want that surgeon. I want somebody who knows how to enter into 60 seconds as if she or he had all the time in the world, because then the hand won't tremble, and then the artery will get tied off, and then the patient will live. But if this person is frenzied and anxious, "I only have 60 seconds, that hand is more likely to tremble, and the patient is more likely to suffer. So that story is a metaphor for me about lots of things, that there's an interesting way in which time is not this sort of external ticking of the clock that drives us. We all know, for example, that if we're doing something meaningful, time seems to expand. And if we're doing something nonsensical, incredibly annoying because we've made a bad choice about how to spend our time, time contracts.
So having this presence in the time, I guess, is what we're talking about, feeling like you're fully present and you're not fighting time, but you're kind of inhabiting it.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it. You're really inhabiting time and you're letting time inhabit you. You're not looking at the clock on the wall as an external driver, but you're sort of giving yourself to the experience. I brought along a poem by a wonderful poet named Naomi Shihab Nye. It's a short little poem called Fresh, which I think speaks to this. And it must have come up for Naomi Shihab Nye around some of the questions that you and I are exploring here. So here's her poem, Fresh. "To move cleanly, needing to be nowhere else, wanting nothing from any store, to lift something you already had and set it down in a new place, awakened eye seeing freshly. What does that do to the old blood moving through its channels?"
I like that.
I love the sensibility of that poem, that there are ways to sort of occupy what we already have, to say, what we need is here. Another great line from another great poet, William Stafford.
Are there any other poems that you turn to when you're feeling this in particular?
Well, there are a lot of them. I didn't bring all of them along. There's a little tiny poem by Rainer Maria Rilke that is one of the few I have memorized because it's so short. And it's a mysterious poem, but I like it very much because it has to do with this merging of the inner and the outer that I think is such an important part of this question. So Rilke says, it's called Ah, Not to be Cut Off. He said, "Ah, not to be cut off, not through the slightest partition shut out from the law of the stars. The inner, what is it, if not intensified sky, hurled through with birds and deep with the winds of homecoming." I think what Rilke is saying to us in that poem is that our inner life contains the universe of possibilities, and the universe comes home in us as we can then come home in it. There's something for me profoundly restful about that poem and this notion of, not to be cut off, not to be cut off from the rhythms of nature, not to be cut off from the rising and setting of the sun, not to be cut off from my true self, not to be cut off from relationship. These are, I think, the treasures that come when we're able to do this, what I call sometimes live our lives on the Mobius strip, that interesting shape where the inner surface and the outer surface merge into each other, a shape that actually has only one surface. And it becomes so clear when you look at the Mobius strip that what's inside and what's outside keep co-creating each other as they flow along.
What is it that you think that does cut us off? Because sometimes it's helpful to look at what's clogging up the drain as well as the solution.
Well, I can speak only for myself, of course, but ego cuts me off sometimes. I want to look good. I want everyone to like me. I want to be smart. I want to be successful. And I think when those become my drivers, rather than a driver like, I want to be of service, I want to be loving, I want to be kind, I want to show up in the world with my gifts and offer them within my limits as needed to whoever needs them. That's a very different way of being present than what happens when my ego starts to dominate. And I, like most people, I think, I struggle with my ego a lot. And I'm talking about an overweening ego. I'm not talking about that fundamental sense of self that you need to stand in the world. I mean, some people have too little and some people have too much. I think I get into trouble when I'm on the too much side.
Oh, you're not alone there. I think you've got some company. Well, we're talking this hour with Parker Palmer. He's our guest in studio today. He is founder and senior partner of the Center for Courage and Renewal, and he's the author of many books, including The Courage to Teach and Healing the Heart of Democracy. And we're slowing down this hour to talk about what we can do in our daily lives to be fully present in time, like we were talking about, to kind of live on that Mobius strip that Parker was just describing so beautifully for us. What do you do when you get crazy busy, and how do you find your way back? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can shoot us an email if you'd rather to talk@wpr.org. And you can also share what's on your mind on our Facebook page at The Veronica Rickert Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert keeping you company today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And coming up at 12:30, join us for Chapter a Day as Jim Fleming reads from The Baseball Codes, Beanballs, Sign Stealing, and Bench Clearing Brawls by Jason Turbo and Michael Duca. I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're joined by Parker Palmer in studio this hour. He is the author of Healing the Heart of Democracy, and he's also founder and senior partner of the Center for Courage and Renewal. And Parker, we'll take our first phone call now, and we'll go to Anne, who's joining us from Harbor Springs, Michigan. Hi, Anne.
Hello, Veronica and Mr. Palmer. I so appreciate your work. I hope I can visit your Center for Courage and Renewal someday.
Oh, thank you. I hope you can.
I live in a very rural area of Michigan, and as the winters come on, depression becomes a really big issue. It is a serious issue for me anyway, and I need to see my friends more, and it's very difficult because they are so busy. They're so busy, they're not listening to the radio right now. So my question is, my friends tend to be of a spiritual nature, not churchgoers, non-denominational, but we do speak a certain language and have a very deep spiritual life. But my question to you is, can you suggest something that I might do, a way that I might gather them around an idea or something, so that to help them let go a little bit in a way that doesn't require a lot of preparation on their part, but some way that I can gather them together once a month or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Well, thank you for a really important question. It's important to me and a lot of people. If you've read a book like Let Your Life Speak or A Hidden Wholeness, two of my books, you know that I have suffered from depression several times in my adult life. So this is a personally important topic to me. And I know that there are times when my need has been to be alone with that. And then I know there are other times when my need is to be with other people. I think what's most important to me about being with other people is that I don't want them there on the assumption that they have to fix me. I think that's what shuts us down and drives us apart from each other, because there are important moments in life, and those struggles in the darkness certainly among them, when we really don't have fixes to offer each other, but what we can offer each other is the gift of presence. I guess one way I'd put it is that what I needed most in depression were friends who weren't afraid of me, who weren't afraid to be in the presence of a depressed person, who didn't somehow think that this was catching and that they would get it too. And I think there is some of that, because many people have cause to be depressed, and they're worried that if they get too near someone who is in depression, they might start to sink as well. So in a book like A Hidden Wholeness, I wrote about something that I call a circle of trust, where people learn how to be present to one another in a way that involves no fixing, no saving, no advising, and no correcting each other or setting each other straight. It instead involves a capacity to listen deeply, a capacity to ask honest, open questions to help hear each other into speech, really a capacity to help each other recover, reclaim that true self that I've been talking about here with Veronica, which is an engaged self, a relational self, but is also grounded in things that one holds dear and holds true. So you raise a big and important question, and probably the best I can do with it in the short time we have is to suggest taking a look at A Hidden Wholeness and the circle of trust process that's described in that book.
Well, thank you so much, Anne. I appreciate your call and wish you well. And we'll go next to Brad, who's with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Brad.
Hello, yes. Just in regard to, how do you stop the busyness? My father, who died 6 years ago when he was 83, he had a saying growing up. He said, you can do and do and do, and there's always more to do. He worked very hard. When I was a little boy, he had three jobs, and he worked very hard to provide for me and Mom. But I also learned from him there's a time to say, I'm going to go swimming. And I remember also as a little boy that he would take me swimming, and we continued swimming together, occasionally going and doing laps until he was 79 years old. Hmm. And I was about 50. And, it was just a sense of, okay, or sit down and we're just going to, read a book or watch a Perry Mason mystery or something, or read a Perry Mason mystery. And so, I learned both hard work for him, but also time to say, okay, we're going to do something to relax.
You're a lucky man to have had a dad like that, right?
Yes, very much so.
Yeah, my dad had some of those same qualities—a very hard worker, but always time for his children, and always an affirming word for his children as well. What your comment puts me in mind of is another important piece, I think, of how we human beings sort of open our eyes to the gifts of life rather than getting so tangled up in its challenges and problems. And it's a very old piece of advice from almost all of the spiritual traditions, and that is daily keep your death before your eyes. As the old saying goes, on the day I die, I'm not going to be concerned about whether I spent enough time at the office. I'm more likely to be wondering if I spent enough time with the people I love or engaged with the world in ways that were life-giving for me and for others. And so this counsel, daily keep your death before your eyes, which when I was young sounded kind of morbid to me, the older I get, and I think a lot of older people would testify to this, the more your impending death helps you to understand the preciousness of every moment of your life, the preciousness of every relationship. And even in problematic times, it helps you understand the importance of showing up with your gifts. I think the saddest way to die would be some sense that I never showed up during the brief span of time I was given. I never showed up as my true self. So a daily practice of trying to show up, even in challenging situations, as who I really am, with my best gifts offered to the world, I think those are the things that are going to count as one's life comes to an end.
Thank you so much for that, Brad. And I want to follow up on that, Parker. How do you know? I mean, I know this is a question to occupy lifetimes, but how do you start answering that question of how to show up as who you really are?
Well, I think, you know, for me, it's, again, it's a complicated answer, and I don't have all the answers by a long shot. I have an inner sense of when something is life-giving for me and when something is death-dealing for me. There are certain relationships that feel very toxic, and I will work and work at trying to detoxify them. But if I can't do that, if this doesn't bring me life, I need to detach from that relationship. There are certain jobs I'm asked to do that I may think I ought to do that. But if I'm operating by those abstract oughts and I'm engaged with a piece of work that isn't life-giving for me, how can it possibly be life-giving for the people with whom I'm working? I need to detach from that. So this basic sense of does this enliven me or does this deaden me seems to me to be important. And at the same time to realize that life is an experiment. An ongoing experiment in who you really are and in what your best gifts are. Someone as great as Gandhi, surely one of the greatest people in human history, titled his autobiography, My Experiments with Truth. And Gandhi saw every day of his life not as sort of acting out some crystal clear truth that he had arrived at last week, last month, or last year, but as an ongoing experiment, test this, test that, see how it works, see how it feels, and allow yourself to keep shaping and reshaping your life around the outcome of those experiments.
Oh, that's reassuring. If Gandhi could be making it up as he goes along, I guess the rest of us can.
Absolutely. Just so he wasn't phoning it in, that we know for sure.
Okay, let's go back to our phone lines. We have joining us Jenny in Madison. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Veronica and Parker. I really appreciate this program today. I have a little dilemma to kind of put before you. I feel like in most of my life, my family and myself, we've always made good decisions about just a set of things you were just saying, which is to, you know, separate from things that don't bring us joy and happiness and to go towards and include more in our lives friendships and relationships that feed us, and I think we've been very successful at that. But I have a son who is a very competitive person, who is a high-level athlete, but who is a very sensitive person on the other hand, and yet he's put himself and the nature of his activity requires the support of our whole family to be involved into a social milieu where of fairly high-level athletics, where outcomes are very objective in the sense that, you know, whatever the clock says is how you view yourself, and that creates a very toxic, mean-spirited, lot of other terms I can't use on the radio, kind of a social environment. And so it's been, even though my son wants to continue to pursue this as an activity in his life and as a goal of his, to have fairly high achievements in this area, there have been a lot of social costs to our family for how to be ourselves, the kind of open, sharing, giving people people that we are in the world and every other place that we go. And yet, having this type of, you know, how having our way of being, open and sharing, really being viewed as a vulnerability, and you know, opening yourself to a group of people who are competitive, you tend to get trounced. And so I'd like to hear what you have to say on being in a social environment like that, if you have to be.
How to deal with that.
Yeah, that's a very challenging situation, and I suppose we can all think of parallels to it in our own lives, but certainly when one's child is involved, and you're not going to walk away from your child. On the other hand, having three children of my own, I do know that it's been necessary at times and possible to sit down with them and say, "Help me understand why this is so important to you. Let me ask you honest, open questions about this environment that you're in, and how you're feeling about it. What are its rewards? What are its costs?" In other words, when you love somebody, you can help them reflect in a non-judgmental way on things that they might not be reflecting on left to their own devices. I detached myself from certain situations as a younger man, situations that I thought were essential to my career, because someone who loved me, who cared about me, asked me those honest, open questions, not pushing me, not trying to get me to lay it down because they thought I ought to lay it down, but just helping me understand that I was paying an internal price for this activity in a way that I had not understood for myself. So that kind of loving, caring, respectful dialogue, where you're not trying to talk anybody into something or out of something, but you're simply sort of holding up a mirror and letting themselves look at themselves in that mirror, can, I think, be enormously useful. The other thing I'd say is that we all find ourselves in toxic situations. And I think the most important thing there, when you think about life on the Mobius strip, as I was talking about a few moments ago, is to not let those toxins get inside of us so that we become reactive to all of that rather than responsive to it. I think bearing witness to another way in these toxic situations, and politics today would be a good example, is an important thing to do. So when I find myself, for example, in a conversation with someone who believes 180 degrees different from what I believe on a hot political topic, I need to keep asking myself a simple question, but a helpful question. Am I here to win this argument, or am I here to create a container in which this person and I can have some sort of ongoing conversation and ongoing relationship? Whenever I'm able to say, I'm here to create a container rather than to win an argument, which I'm not going to win anyway, it helps take a next step toward human connectedness, which I think is the most important thing we've got going for us.
Well, Jenny, thank you so much, and I hope that was helpful. And I want to follow up, because sometimes, you know, you could sit down with Jenny's son, she could sit down with him, and he could realize there are costs, and that indeed this environment surrounding this activity is really toxic and makes him feel bad and has all these costs. But on the other hand, maybe he really loves the activity. Mm-hmm. You know, let's say it's running. Maybe there's something mm-hmm. that speaks to his spirit about running.
Mm-hmm.
So he wants to stay involved in that activity. What if there are what in those situations where you can't decouple?
Mm-hmm. Well, as I say, I don't think it's about talking him into or out of anything, but just giving him a chance to look at it. Let me take an example from my own life, because I'm always on safer ground there, because I know the details. I have a son who's a very gifted scientist, but he does not like the social environment of academic science one little bit. He feels that it crushes his spirit. And so I've had this conversation with him for going on 20 years. And where he's come down is that he's found a way to maximize the doing of his science and minimize his need to drink from the poisoned well of how academic science in his setting is getting done. He's found a way to, you know, go farther toward the light that drew him to science while letting the darkness of how science gets done in certain situations recede. I think our conversations have helped him make that movement. But I also think with our children or with anybody else, we have to let them make their own final choices about these things. And we have to rest easy with the notion that every soul has its own destiny. And each of us sort of, as the old saying goes, works out our salvation in fear and trembling. And usually it's an old story about the fellow who lived down the hill from a monastery years and years without knowing what went on up there. And so one day he walks up the hill, knocks on the door, and the abbot comes out and he says, "Really, Father, I don't understand. What are you guys doing here?" And the abbot says, "Well, we get up, then we fall down, then we get up, then we fall down, then we get up, and we fall down, and we get up again." I think for most of us, that's the way it goes. And I think the most important thing we can do to people who like us who are going through that cycle is to stay with them through the whole cycle and not abandon them when they fall down.
Mm, beautifully put. Well, we're talking this hour with Parker Palmer, who has been kind enough to come into the studio today. He is the founder and senior partner of the Center for Courage and Renewal and the author of many books, including his latest called Healing the Heart of Democracy. And we'd love to hear from you this hour about your challenges staying centered and true to yourself in a crazy world and in this, you know, somewhat bitter political season that we're in right now. How are you weathering that? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And you can also choose to shoot us an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert back with you here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And coming up at 1 o'clock, join us for a talk of the nation, Science Friday. Can statistics predict the next president? Join guest Flora Lichtman on Science Friday for a look at how to decipher the polls and why not all votes are created equal. And plus, we'll hear what space sounds like and how the moon was born. That's 1 o'clock's Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. This hour, I'm joined in studio with Parker Palmer, who is a founder and senior partner of the Center for Courage and Renewal, and he's the author of many books, including his latest, Healing the Heart of Democracy. And earlier, Parker, you were talking about how when life gets hectified for you, one of the places you turn is poetry. It kind of flips a switch for you and maybe turns you into a more contemplative frame of mind. And you brought some poems with us, so why don't you share one more?
Yeah, Let me read one by a poet that not many people know. Her name is Jean, J-E-A-N-N-E, Lohmann, L-O-H-M-A-N-N. And she's just published a new book in her 80s now, and I'm eager for people to know more about her. And this is a poem called Questions Before Dark. Questions Before Dark. Day ends, and before sleep, when the sky dies down, consider your altered state. Has this day changed you? Are the corners sharper or rounded off? Did you live with death? Make decisions that quieted. Find one clear word that didn't fit. At the sun's midpoint, did you notice a pitch of absence? Bewilderment that invites the possible. What did you learn from the things you dropped and picked up and dropped again? Did you set a straw parallel to the river, let the flow carry you downstream? I love the poet's gift. You know, the questions that we've been asked this hour, the questions that we ask ourselves, these are big, big, big questions. And I often think of what Emily Dickinson said. She said, about big questions, tell the truth, but tell it slant.
I've heard that before, and I always think that is so beautiful. What does it mean? And I don't know, so I'm so glad you brought that up.
I think it means that some questions are so big you just can't run headlong at them. You know, how do I do this? How do I do that? You have to glimpse the answers out of the corner of your eye. And I think that's what poets do in their poetry. I think when Jean Lohman says, "What did you learn from the things you dropped and picked up and dropped again?" It's a mysterious question, and yet it's a question that we can somehow connect with. Are the corners sharper or rounded off? Did you make decisions that quieted? You know, all of this is glancing at stuff out of the corner of your eye and picking up clues as the dark settles and you go to sleep about how you might want to do it the next day.
Mm. Yes, a poem like that you could really sink into and think about for a long time. Let's take another phone call. We go now to Brenda. She's joining us from Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Brenda.
Hello. I've really enjoyed listening to this as I'm cleaning my house this morning.
Oh, thank you.
And I just wanted to share something. I started daily meditation about 3 years ago, and I have become so addicted to it that if I miss a day or so, then I really start feeling kind of frazzled. And like any addict, I always like to tell the world about, you know, kind of, I become a pusher, a meditation pusher. And I know that a lot of people say, well, I can't meditate because I sit there and my mind starts wandering to the grocery list and all those different things. And I had seen Maria Shriver interviewed, I think, on Oprah a number of years ago. And she was talking about her practice of meditation. And she said that she just started off with 30 seconds. If she could just kind of be there for 30 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And then she became addicted to it, too. I also find that if I have little readings or cues from different things, everything from the Bible to books, probably like yours, Parker, although I have never read any of yours, but I intend to, I think they kind of help move your mind along into the areas that it needs to go.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree completely, and thank you for mentioning some of these formal practices of meditation. What you said very clearly and well, and I agree with it. I would only add that I think in our culture, people sometimes confuse meditation with a particular technique. I think different people have very different ways of meditating. One of the great spiritual teachers I know was talking with a woman one day who was wrestling with some serious things, and she said, "I just can't meditate." He said, what helps you settle your heart? And she said, "Knitting." And he said, "Then create a corner in your house where you just sit and knit when the waters get too roiled, and let that be your meditation. Call that your meditation." And I think he was absolutely right. I think about creating a space where we can settle inwardly, and the world can come to us in a new way. But thank you so much for your comments.
Yes, thank you so much, Brenda. And along that same vein, we have a message here from Bobby who writes, "For me, I found that meditation is important. It can be difficult to make the time, but even 10 minutes in the morning can set the tone for the whole day."
I agree completely. And again, I go back to what we were talking about earlier, that there are certain things that we do to which we think, okay, I have to add this to my to-do list. But instead of eating up our time, they actually open up our time.
Huh, that's interesting. Are there other things like that besides meditation where if we would just stop, you know, we would get a whole lot more out of our day?
Well, I think, you know, again, for me, it's things like altering my rhythm, my pace during the day. I'm a writer. I've written for 45 years. And it's very easy for me to spend 6, 8, 10 hours nonstop looking at the monitor and crafting language, breaking only when my wife says, "You've got to come eat lunch," or at 3 p.m., "For goodness sakes, Parker, act like a grown-up and get dressed and shower and shave." So I need reminders from myself and other people to get up every now and then, to stare out the window, to take a little walk in the park near our house, to handwrite a letter to somebody, to to open a poetry volume and read a few things. And then when I go back to my writing, I find myself refreshed. I find my mind and my eyes opened in new ways.
Hmm. Well, let's see if we can fit another call or two in before the end of the hour. We've got Darlise next from Green Bay. Hi there.
Hi, this is Dar Saladino. Your words echo all the words that I say to my dearest friends, and I could talk to you for hours and hours. I was looking for the psychology section in the library when I was perhaps in 9th or 10th grade. I got in the wrong section. I got in the section called philosophy. And I started reading Zen Buddhist literature and poetry and wisdom when I was a kid. and today I just wanted to say a couple things about my favorite Zen koan. Are you familiar with koans?
I surely am, yes.
Yeah. And as I'm standing here, I'm looking at a stoneware sculpture of two very old Chinese men sitting on the ground and playing a game on a very low table. And my favorite koan, I see this in these gentlemen. And the koan is by Basho.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just talks of a lot of truth in very succinctly presented words. And it is, with one who knows and doesn't speak all he knows, I'm enjoying the cool.
Very nice. Mm-hmm. Very, very, very nice. Yeah, and I think we each of us has something like that within us, you know, one who knows and doesn't speak all that he or she knows. I'm also led to by that comment for reasons I don't quite understand, but I'm led to say that for me, and I think for lots of us, it's really, really important to cut ourselves a lot of slack with this stuff. We're not going to get it right all the time, or maybe even very often. But it's sort of being on the journey toward the kind of wisdom that you just talked about that counts. And forgiving ourselves for not being there every moment of every day, or even every day of every week, is something I think that is really important for those of us who are driven by a desire to get it right. Thank you.
Yes, thank you for that call. And we've only got a couple minutes left to go in the hour, but real briefly, we are in a season which can feel pretty toxic to a lot of people, the political season, the election season. I was telling you, Parker, about a comment on Facebook I read yesterday. Someone said, I wish the election was over so I could go back to liking my friends again. How do we navigate these waters right now? It's a pressurized time, and it cuts to the core of what people believe.
Well, I take my citizenship in this democracy very seriously, as I know lots of us do. But I take it so seriously that I work very hard not to get hooked into the mass media, which are mainly in the business of peddling caricatures of what's going on politically, of presenting problems on such a vast scale at such a fast pace that the media help disempower us. Not all media, not public radio, not some other media sources that I can name, but I think you understand what I mean. That the media so many people are hooked into are actually agents of disempowerment for ordinary citizens. They make us feel like this stuff is too big and it's speeding along so quickly that what could I possibly do about it? Maybe I'll cast my vote, maybe I won't, but even if I do, I won't feel like I'm making much difference. Mm. All politics is local. I try to get my news from conversations with trusted friends of different political orientations and opinions. Try to engage my community in ways that upbuild the democratic possibilities in our society, and try to detach as much as possible from the frenzy that makes me less, not more.
Well, we'll leave it there. And Parker, thank you so much for joining us. It's
thank
been
you.
Just wonderful to talk with you.
Thank you, Veronica.
Parker Palmer with us in studio. He is the author of Healing the Heart of Democracy and a senior partner at the Center for Courage and Renewal. Thanks to Marika Suval for producing this hour and Rhonda Fanning for technical direction. I'm Veronica Rickert wishing you a beautiful weekend, and I'll see you back here next Friday on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.